Good morning and welcome to The Bridge, Coast Community Radio's own weekly news magazine. I'm your host, Kate Brister. On this edition, we'll focus on science and the sea. We'll hear about new research from Oregon State University concerning non-fatal injuries in the Dungeness crab industry. These injuries are often life-changing, if not fatal, and have gone underreported. Scott McDougall and Jennifer Rollette from Pacific County Emergency Management cross the bridge to let us know about community tsunami awareness forums being held next week and again in March. We'll hear details in just a few minutes. But first, Jefferson Public Radio's Leah Moriarty reports from Salem and the Klamath Basin. In December, Congress adjourned without passing legislation to ratify a trio of agreements meant to end the long-standing water wars in the Klamath Basin. This essentially killed the deal, arrived at through years of painstaking negotiations between farmers, ranchers, tribes, and other groups. Now there's a move to demolish four dams on the Klamath River through a separate regulatory process, bypassing the need for congressional approval. Liam takes a look at how this unexpected turn could shape the ongoing Klamath saga.
As time was running out on the three Klamath agreements last year, supporters of the deal stressed how arduous it had been to arrive at consensus in the Klamath Basin's bitter water disputes. Don Gentry, chairman of the Klamath Tribes, said that political efforts to strip dam removal from the hard-fought agreements threatened to torpedo the whole deal.
It's pretty clear that the parties are all on board. That's part of the package, and without that dam removal component, the agreements will unravel.
Tribes, fishermen, and conservationists have wanted the dams removed to allow salmon to return to the upper reaches of the river. Greg Walden and other Republican members of Congress have vigorously opposed dam removal. Now that the old Klamath Agreement has officially expired, there appears to be an increased willingness to unbundle issues from the overall package and try to get them approved on their own. The first move came this week when Oregon and California, along with federal agencies and PacifiCorp, the owner of the Klamath hydropower dams, agreed in principle on a separate process to remove the dams by 2020. PacifiCorp Rep. Bob Graveling.
What this move is intended to do is to take what has been the most contentious piece of the broader package, look for a way to move it in an alternative path that does not require congressional involvement, so that we have a better chance not just to enact that piece, but also the broader settlement.
The federal license to operate the dams has expired, and Gravely says PacifiCorp would rather decommission the aging dams than pay to retrofit them to meet modern water quality and fish passage standards. Craig Tucker with the Karuk Tribe in Northern California is pleased that dam removal looks like it's moving ahead.
The removal of the lower four Klamath dams is probably the biggest action of salmon restoration in history. So it's certainly a great start.
But Tucker says many other issues that had been hashed out in the rest of the Klamath deal still need to be dealt with. Glenn Spain with the Pacific Coast Federation of Fishermen's Associations agrees.
We've got major water shortages in an overappropriated basin. We've got multiple federal and tribal water claims that conflict. And we have a lot of problems that are still going to need some congressional action.
Spain says it's important to get the other agreements put in place. Not everyone's on board. The Hoopa Valley Tribe in California didn't sign the Klamath deal. The tribe's attorney, Thomas Schlosser, praises the new dam removal initiative, but says the Klamath Basin Restoration Agreement would have allowed too much water to be taken out of the system.
We know how much water fish need, and we know how much water is projected to be available after the diversions authorized by the KBRA, and it's not enough for fish.
Conservation groups such as Water Watch and Oregon Wild have similar objections. For Oregon Senator Jeff Merkley, who co-sponsored the failed bill to implement the three Klamath agreements, the new dam removal plan is a chance to revive the rest of the deal.
I think that removing the issue of the dams from the legislation is a huge opportunity for us to work together on the balance of the package.
But even some who supported the expired agreements think it's going to be hard to put Humpty Dumpty back together. The Klamath Tribe's Don Gentry says tribal members will need to approve any new deal, and he says the landscape has changed since they signed onto the original agreement.
I know that there are some issues that would need to be addressed, and we have some concerns and issues that would need to move forward with any potential future settlement.
For farmers and ranchers in the basin, the new dam removal proposal is worrisome. Under the old deal, they agreed to dam removal in exchange for a promise of stable access to water. Now it seems the dams will come down anyway. Scott White with the Klamath Water Users Association says with that quid pro quo gone,
there's certainly a fear on our end that, you know, perhaps that's not going to be the way it goes. We don't want to be hung out left in the weeds, so to speak. That's ultimately our fear.
Becky Hyde is a rancher with the Upper Klamath Water Users Association. She was a negotiator during the many years of struggle to reach the now expired agreements. She hopes the trust and goodwill that developed between the parties during those negotiations will be enough to guide them to a new deal.
It's not the neighborhood's fault that we couldn't get things moving in Congress, so we shouldn't necessarily take that out on one another.
The new dam removal plan is not a slam dunk. There are several issues that could derail it, including access to public funding in California. But the parties to that plan intend to have a basic agreement worked out by the end of February. I'm Liam Moriarty reporting.
A plan for the Klamath Basin water use agreements may have expired in Congress, but at least part of it was resuscitated this week. The states of Oregon and California, the Utility Pacific Corps, and two federal agencies, Commerce and Interior, say they're moving forward to amend the Klamath Hydroelectric Settlement Agreement to remove four dams in the basin by 2020. For tribes and sportsmen in the region, it's one more chance to restore native fish runs. Congress couldn't agree on it before last year's session ended, so Klamath Tribes Chairman Don Gentry says a new approach was needed.
Just an attempt to keep this in the hands of the states and Pacific Corps and the parties. The opposition was to federal authorization for dam removal. And so this is basically keeping it out of the hands of the federal government, so it won't require legislation.
Gentry says it's been almost 100 years since the first dam was built in the region, which cut off migration of salmon and steelhead to the tribe's treaty rights fishing areas. So far, the states and agencies have agreed only to embark on this new path. The details are still to be worked out. Taking out dams is only one phase of a larger, more complex water rights picture. The Klamath Basin Restoration Agreement is the part that expired at the end of December without the congressional approval. That leaves all the parties to that agreement facing all the same concerns about how to share a scarce resource. Brian Johnson with Trout Unlimited says they realize they're still in it together.
For the master water sharing, you know, nobody really knows how we'll do it, but irrigators, ranchers, tribes, conservation groups, we all still see a need to work those issues out and believe that cooperatively is better than fighting about it.
Johnson says all parties will also have a chance to weigh in on the dam removal proposal as it unfolds. He adds that no federal money is needed for removing the dams. Pacific Corps and the state of California will cover it. Commercial Dungeness crab fishing on the West Coast is one of the highest risk occupations in the United States based on fatality rates. Non-fatal injuries in the fishery appear to go largely unreported, according to a new study from Oregon State University. The study found that while the rate of fatal injuries was 65 times higher than the rate for all United States workers, the reported non-fatal injury rate was 3 times lower than the rate for all United States workers. Fatality rates in the Dungeness crab fleet have been reported in the past, but the incident of non-fatal injuries have not been previously studied, according to Laurel Kinkle, an assistant professor of environmental and occupational health and safety in the OSU College of Public Health and Human Sciences. According to Kinkle, the commercial Dungeness fishing fleet, which operates along the coasts of Oregon, Washington, and Northern California, is a vital economic commodity. Injuries can be life-threatening and life-altering, leading to disability, decreased quality of life, and lost wages. Understanding the type and nature of fatalities and injuries, including describing and categorizing the types of injuries, is the first step in identifying safety issues and pinpointing areas for prevention. Kinkle and a team of researchers examined 12 years of death and injury data and found that 28 people died while commercially fishing for Dungeness crab from 2002 to 2014. In that same period, just 45 injuries were reported to the U.S. Coast Guard. Fatal injuries are tracked in a national system, but non-fatal injuries are not. The fatality rate among Dungeness crab fishermen is several times higher than the national rate for commercial fishing, but the injury rate among Dungeness crab fishermen is much lower than injury rates in other commercial fishing fleets that have been studied. The findings, published in the latest issue of the journal International Maritime Health, are the first step to better understanding fishing injuries among Dungeness crab fishermen. The research is part of an OSU-led research project to identify and research the risks of injuries in the industry. The Fisherman-Led Injury Prevention Program, or FLIP, is designed to take a new approach to fishing industry injury prevention by working with commercial Dungeness crab fishermen to identify and reduce injury risks. The project is supported by a three-year, $825,000 grant from the National Institutes for Occupational Safety and Health, and Kinkle is the principal investigator. The researchers found that the majority of the fatalities, about 71%, occurred during vessel disasters such as boats capsizing or sinking. The other deaths were a result of a fisherman drowning or falling overboard. Fractures were the most commonly reported injury at 40%, followed by hypothermia, lacerations, and digit amputations. The majority of injured crew members were deckhands at 88%. And now we take a look at three states and three ways of addressing whether and how to raise statewide minimum wage. In Oregon this week, the State House takes up a three-tiered wage increase that passed the State Senate last Thursday. In Washington State, activists are preparing to hit the streets for a statewide initiative. Meanwhile, Idaho lawmakers are mulling whether to block both a statewide and any possible local increases in the minimum wage at all. Correspondent Tom Bonsi has the report.
Labor and community activists have filed citizen initiatives to significantly raise the state minimum wage in Oregon and Washington. In Oregon, that's set off a scramble in the state legislature. Democratic Senator Michael Dembro of Portland called on lawmakers to pass an alternative, one that could potentially win broad acceptance and head off a ballot fight.
Look, the easiest thing for us to do would be to duck this issue, to take a walk and let it go to the ballot. But that, colleagues, is not why we're here.
The Democratic majority in the Oregon legislature and Governor Kate Brown are backing a phased-in three-tier approach. The pending measure would increase the minimum wage to as much as $14.75 per hour over the next 6 years. In Olympia, Washington lawmakers briefly considered trying to head off their state's ballot measure, too. Several Democrats proposed to phase in a $12 state minimum wage, along with paid sick leave. That's lower than the $13.50 minimum with paid leave in an initiative set to begin circulating petitions next month. Neither is acceptable to major business groups. Jan G. lobbies for independent supermarket owners. She says any big increase in the minimum wage would drive away low-margin businesses like groceries.
At my recent board meeting and legislative visits, it was described as, do I want to get shot in the arm and get maimed, or do I want a shot direct to the heart?
G addressed state lawmakers at the same hearing as an in-home caregiver who's one of the faces of the ballot measure campaign in Washington. Sharon Kitchell of Olympia is still working at age 73.
I currently am paid $12.20 an hour. I face daily with hard choices. For instance, what do I give up this month to stay in my small rented house? I can only afford to heat two rooms. Which two rooms do I heat?
The so-named Raise Up Washington campaign needs to gather nearly 250,000 valid voter signatures to qualify their proposed minimum wage increase for the statewide ballot in November. If both Washington and Oregon vote for a higher minimum wage, that will set up a cliff of sorts along the Idaho border. Idaho sticks to the federal minimum wage of $7.25 per hour. Activists such as Adrian Evans of Boise have tried for several years to get Idaho legislators to entertain an increase to no avail.
We need to stop pretending like we live in isolation. What will happen and what is happening will only exacerbate the problem that Idaho faces today. We have more young people leaving the state because they cannot get ahead.
The president of the Idaho Retailers Association is less concerned by the disparity between neighboring states. Pam Eden says it might impact wages in border cities, but is unlikely to reach deep into Idaho. I'm Tom Bonsi reporting.
You're listening to The Bridge. That's a long 60 seconds, isn't it? We remember that sound from the Great Oregon Shakeout last October. Earthquake and the resulting damage will probably be just one component of the big one. For coastal towns and cities, the tsunami that may follow will have its own destruction. In February and March, the Pacific County Emergency Preparedness staff will join with first responders, the Washington Department of Natural Resources, and others for an opportunity to learn how we may be impacted and can prepare for a Cascadia subduction zone earthquake and tsunami. Scott McDougall, the Deputy Director of Pacific County Emergency Management, and Event Coordinator Jessica Rollette joined us to talk about the community awareness forums. Scott began by describing the subduction zone and its powerful influence on the coast.
I think the thing that makes the Cascadia subduction zone the most unique and interesting thing is that it's so long. It starts in Northern California and it continues up into the coast of British Columbia. And so if the entire fault ruptures, it's going to produce what's called a megaquake. The shaking will last. They're talking about the possibility of the shaking lasting for 4 to 6 minutes. That's not anything like I've ever experienced in my lifetime. And so you may not feel a huge sense of the ground shaking. If you were here for the Nisqually quake, for example, the ground shook substantially during that earthquake, but for a shorter period of time. And as that fault ruptures from the south to the north, or from the north to the south, all of that time that it takes for that fault to rupture, the earthquake will be continuing. Mm-hmm. And so as it continues, buildings will be put in more risk as they continue to sway, and that's where a lot of the damage will come from. So as we prepare for Cascadia Rising, we will work with the Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA. We'll work with the Department of Homeland Security. We'll work with the Washington State Emergency Management Division. In this instance, we'll also be working with the Washington National Guard. And then we will work down the chain to local emergency management. We work a lot within the four counties, the four coastal counties in the state of Washington, Pacific, Grace Harbor, Jefferson, and Clallam. We're all kind of in this together, and so the four Washington coastal counties have a tsunami work group that meets on a quarterly basis, and we plan a unified approach to how we're going to deal with tsunamis and earthquakes off the coast, a Cascadia subduction event in particular. We also work with the National Weather Service. We work with the Department of Natural Resources as we begin talking about this forum that we're going to be putting on. We will be dealing with the Chief Hazard Engineer from the Washington State Department of Natural Resources, Tim Walsh, and we'll be dealing with George Crawford, who is a retired earthquake and tsunami manager within the Washington State Emergency Management Division. There's just a whole plethora of people that come together to make sure that our community does understand that this is a survivable event. We are finally developing a conversation all along the West Coast of people who are now understanding that this is something that's really a little bit scary, but at the same time we want people to understand that with preparation, it's a survivable event.
For the community forums that we're doing, I have been planning with the Washington State Emergency Management Division. I've been in contact with someone from Department of Natural Resources, and they're going to come and speak at the event about the different geological hazards that we have, and then also what you can do when this happens and how you can prepare. I'm hoping that a bunch of people from the community will come and that they'll be able to educate themselves and maybe even just go out and talk to their neighbor and be like, hey, I learned this. Are you prepared? Mm-hmm. And it's just a really great opportunity to kind of reach out and gather these people in.
We have quite a selection of tsunami evacuation maps, handouts that detail how to prepare for an event, handouts just generally talking about preparedness. And those information pieces will be available. I think one of the biggest responsibilities and obligations we have is just to share as much information as possible so that the community is as well informed as they can be, which will aid in their preparation. Just really would like to encourage folks. I think there's one thing that's really important to understand, and that is due to the topography off the coast, the event in Oregon and the event in Washington will not be the same. But the idea of preparedness remains the same. And so you may prepare in Clatsop County differently than you do in Pacific County. But we would encourage our neighbors from Clatsop County to come on across and visit us and find out a little bit more about what we're doing on our side of the river to prepare. Because in the end, we're all going to be in this together.
On February 24th, the Community Tsunami Awareness Forums will be held at 2 o'clock to 4 p.m. at the Pacific County Fire District 1, 26110 Ridge Avenue in Ocean Park, and then again from 7 to 9 p.m. at the Ilwaco Community Room, 158 First Avenue North, Ilwaco. On March 16th, in Tokeland, they'll be from 2 to 4 p.m. at the Shoalwater Bay Tribal Center, 2373 Old Tokeland Road, and that evening, 7 p.m. to 9 p.m., the Commissioner's Meeting Room, 1216 West Robert Bush Drive in South Bend, Washington. That's all the time we have on this edition of The Bridge. If you missed any part of it or just want to hear it again, it's available as a podcast on our website at coastradio.org. We love hearing from you. Send your questions or comments to News 1. That's NEWS and the numeral 1 at KMUN.org. Put The Bridge in the subject line. I'm Kate Brister. Thank you for listening, and join us next time on The Bridge.